Welcome back to the Four Podmen. We hope you're all still with us. We are still alive. There were three, now we are four once again. Today is a very special show because A, we've got great content for you, but B, we do welcome a brand new full-time member to the Four Podmen. It's been teased. People were wondering. We kind of leaked it on Dynamo's Dozen the other day, but it is officially the man, the myth, the legend himself, Jason Kennedy. So I think it's only fair to let the new man say a few pieces, and then we'll all welcome him to the show.
Yeah, appreciate it, Ian. Hello. Great, thank you. And I'm not sorry for anything I say, ever. Full stop.
I think it's good to put that premise in there first. I think that's a good way to start.
Absolutely. You can ram it up your lala.
This show comes in with the parental advisory explicit.
No filters. No yeah, filter there.
Exactly. And the two boys are here, obviously, as usual. The mighty
Whoa.
And, of course, the shopkeeper, Niall Hogan. We're going to have to get a nickname for Jay. He is usually known as DJ Road Dog on the DJ scene here in Dublin. However, we don't know with lawsuits whether he would still be allowed to be.
Apparently, some other hack uses it.
Some kind of hick. Yeah.
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. to be fair,
they haven't liked you very much, have they?
We should probably. That is one of the recent deaths, actually. Bullet Bob Armstrong passed away there about a week ago. So, condolences from Four Podmen to that great legend family.
Absolutely.
Another one gone, but a good lifespan and a great career to be left behind. But today, obviously, first and foremost, I guess, before we get on today's show, which is, of course, the most controversial probably topic in wrestling history, period, and even to this day. And it's how many years later? 28 years later, yeah, it's nearly 30 years.
It's 28, yeah.
23, no. Lads. It was 97.
It was 97.
Jesus.
What did we think it was 92?
Well, lads, I'm good
at... 23 years, lads, even with calculated grades.
I'm good at articulation. I'm good at spelling. I'm not good at maths. That's where you're meant to come in straight away because Niall is the scorekeeper and he's meant to be coming in here with the numbers instantly.
Typical Finglas, stick a fiver on it.
No, I was going to say, typical Liverpool fan, they know exactly what about numbers now they do. You know what I
mean? There's no need.
Well,
you're upsetting yourself.
Pushing.
Times are hard, so that 5 euros going out of two, but we will get back to that once again. But yeah, I guess, obviously, it's been a while. We do obviously want to thank Darragh O'Connor for the shows that you've heard up until this point. He's moved on. Mm-hmm. Still doing his own thing. We've brought Jay in. Obviously, we are very, very happy with the replacement. Jay is someone that was actually on my list when we actually came up with the concept of this, you know, concept for this show. So we're glad to finally have him. We have a pandemic to thank for it, but we have
the dummy run went well.
Yeah, we've done a dummy run as well. So if that is anything to go by, ladies and gentlemen, I would strap into your seats. If you're on a treadmill, get off it. Listen to this right now. If you're whatever else you're doing, you should be fine. But if you're on a treadmill, don't, because this is going to be good. We've got some really good concepts, you know, as we've established 23 years later, some good concepts on what actually happened that day, where we stand now, how it actually changed the course of wrestling, and so on and so forth. But I guess we will move right into it. So obviously, we started the last time by just kind of giving just a brief synopsis of it. November 9th, 1997, Bell Centre, Montreal, Canada. Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels obviously meet again, finally after the Iron Man match at WrestleMania 12. Amidst a lot of controversy, a lot of the dirt sheets at the time are speculating that Bret's gone. Some of them have a handle on the fact that he has signed a deal with Turner and whatnot. But there was just a real kind of a feeling in the air that something wasn't going to go right in the build-up to that. Why don't you boys take me back to how you was kind of, you know, felt around that time? Because, I mean, that was the the start of the boom period once again in wrestling. That was literally the beginning of the Attitude Era, that whole late 96 all the way to I suppose, yeah, from November 96 pretty much to November 97 was really the prelude to what we got as the you know, as the Attitude Era. Who wants to jump in first on that?
Shopkeeper, go for it.
Yeah, well, it was kind of like you didn't really know too much about it, except you knew there was kind of a bit of animosity there, and the build-up to it all felt very real and stuff like that, you know. But you never knew at all. There was no inkling at all of what was going to unfold that night, and, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, it was just probably a lot of people barely even knew probably that Brett was heading off to WCW, you know what I mean? So, like, it was kind of like, it was a fairly well-kept, you know, it was kind of, most people at this stage probably know it was a decision that was practically made on the day, but I'm sure Vince had it in his mind for a while, you know what I mean? He knew what he wanted to do. He was just moving around the chess pieces to make it happen. But, to me it was kind of like, I sort of went into it, I remember at the time, like it was another pay-per-view. And I wasn't expecting anything like that to happen. So the shock factor was huge, you know what I mean? A la Lesnar, Undertaker, you know, that kind of way. You didn't expect what was unfolding to unfold, and you didn't expect it to become that real either, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think everyone up to the point where Brett does the WCW thing probably thought it was just part of the show, like, you know?
I think the part where he was leaning over the ropes and he spat down on Vince and stuff like that, that kind of made it a bit more sort of, you know what I mean? Because that's kind of not that. That's kind of at that stage not the kind of thing that sort of. They left all that stuff for Heyman and his crowd. You know what I mean? So
yeah, true. Yeah.
So that was kind of, and you could see as well as I suppose when Davey Boy came out and the rest of the kind of family came out, it made it very real. You know, and then you could see it in Brett's face. Then, you know, like he was just distraught and devastated, and you can tell by then that it kind of wasn't a work, or it wasn't like, you know, hamming it up or something like that. The guy was in a really bad place at the time, you know. So you could feel the, you know, the way people say you can feel the emotion and stuff like that, you know, you could really feel it. The guy really felt he's being hard done by in front of his own people, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, we've established that there's only French Canadians, but that still matters.
yeah. French Canadian lives matter.
French Canadian, no. In the Bell Centre.
That's what side of the mouth they're talking out of, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's just more of a jab at the Montreal Canadiens.
It depends on which tax bill is due.
Yeah, exactly. But, Jay, I suppose we're going to get into, some of the... It's not... But like, there's some amazing theories that you have, obviously, based on that as well. But I think we're not going to jump right into that and give away... Show our hands straight away. Do you know what I mean? You're going to butter them
excellent,
up.
This is, yeah.
We're calling it in the ring here. We're just chaining. We're feeling each other out a little bit. And we'll get the high spots for later on. But I think one of the things, obviously leading up to it, the whole premise, you know, we don't have to give a step-by-step of what happened, because unless people have been living under a rock, they know exactly what's happened with Montreal. It's been on every shoot interview, every kind of documentary that involves the word wrestling known to man. But you will always
revealed, yeah, the most hindsight revealed incident in professional in the history of professional wrestling.
Yeah,
everything is being said about every moment leading up and going out of it. And I think Noel touched on something there as well, that back then there wasn't the benefit of the internet. Everybody's opinions were born 20 years after the fact. There was still a lot of fucking tight rope and off. Even most of the magazines that were coming out at the time would have still been pro work, you know.
Yeah.
You would have had a lot of kayfabe still at that stage.
That, well, it was all there. Yeah, it was all there.
Yeah, I mean, that was just... I mean, the real people trying to keep kayfabe in place were still there. Obviously,
still trying.
Shawn Michaels and his cronies done their best to get rid of that, obviously, with the curtain call. But they done their best to get rid of anything. But sure, look, they're not doing too well now themselves. So that's a story for another day. Shout out to you, Scott Hall. You know, it's funny, isn't it? Because we have Carl laughing at me here. He likes the little sarcasm.
That's me as well. Like, I mean, when you said that there, I was thinking, Jesus, Hunter did all right, didn't he?
Most certainly. Better bed.
You know, For a lad who was punished so much, Jesus, he did well, didn't he?
But isn't it ironic that all these years later, Hunter is actually doing his best in NXT to undo the damage that him and his little boy has done at the time by trying to bring some validity and
guilt is a hell of a motivator the longer you live.
Absolutely, I love that, Jay, and I know where you're going with that, and that's 100% true, because we can laugh at it and people go, ah, well, kayfabe, this, blah, 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 it's better now. Fans of this generation are going to say that nowadays, and the only reason they're going to say that is purely because they like to, people generally like to feel that they're in on the gag. You know what I mean? People like to feel that they're in on the trick. When a magician is doing something on TV, people like to feel like that they know how that's done, even if they haven't a clue. They might have an inkling as to how it possibly goes, but they really want to know. So that's just fans in general. And that's psychology. Look, that's not really... I wouldn't grill fans for that. You know what I mean? That's not their fault.
But see, you're ruining my Wrestling with Shadows moment now, because I was a big Triple H fan. And when he said in the corridor that he knew nothing about it, I was very happy.
And he swore to God.
That's okay. Hunter didn't know. He's a good guy.
And he swore to God.
Come on, shopkeeper. I love Triple H, but come on, the fuck.
I'm trying to draw you out, Kyle.
I think the many years of Hunter's work as he started to get to the top also fits in line with how good a guy Hunter may or may not have been.
That moment on that video though, when she, remember when Brett's missus goes up and goes, "You knew Hunter, you knew," and he's just going,
"Yeah, like a little bald boy."
Well, to be honest,
an animal out of the Road Warriors. You knew too, Joe. You knew. and animal's going, "What you talking about?"
Well, I don't think she said that to the Road Warriors. It was the other boy.
He was beside Hunter. Remember, he was standing right beside Hunter during that segment.
Yeah, but I think that was chastisation, because I actually only watched it again yesterday for review of the show. It was 100%. It was all on Hunter, and I think Hunter also knew what was in that locker room and probably heard a few smacks and was probably literally trying to think how he was going to pay for room service to change the jobs that he was wearing, to be fair.
He probably brought Joe along in case Brett's missus battered him.
Well, as far as I know, the LOD were more the Anvil and Brett's crowd, to be fair.
Absolutely.
So that's why I'm going to call you out on that one, shopkeeper. Because it was literally the click and then no one else. Do you know what I mean? But anyway, we digress. We can move along from that. I think it's... and then it turns out Hunter was actually the one that came up with the idea. Why wouldn't he? He knew he was going to marry Stephanie when she was probably 14 years old as well. That's the kind of guy
The man had some mind for the business.
Oh, yeah.
Good enough for Macho Man.
I was just going to say, that was the Macho Man, not Triple H.
We really are parental advisory here now, aren't we? Wow, we're going there. I like it, though. I mean, I'm happy with it. I'm not, you know, it's... what was it? Cream of the crap. Yeah.
Well, he alluded to as much himself in that little promo, didn't he?
Yeah. It's a very strange one. That's one of the conspiracy theories I'm not sure about, to be fair. It's just one of them that kind of came out of left field. I'm not sure.
I don't know.
Don't even divulge into that now. We're going to ruin wrestling for us.
A different show.
I don't think we need to go there either. I think we should move swiftly along. But, so obviously the match, and by the way, we did spend time on this, and obviously on the little kind of practice run, which should definitely be talked about, because obviously since then, you guys have actually went back and watched the match in full again. And it was something that I pointed out from a wrestling standpoint. When you can actually take away what happened in that match in terms of in terms of the heat that Brett and Sean had built both behind the scenes, but masterfully creating that on screen as well. I have to say, that was a period in wrestling where you don't really see that kind of heat on screen anymore. Even it was something very majestic between the two guys and between the two groups, obviously DX and the Hart Foundation. When you go back and watch that match, it made all the sense in the world, because it didn't just start off as your typical wrestling match. This match, obviously Sean comes out, he's getting milk thrown, he's getting spat at, you know, he's obviously playing the heel, he's smiling, he's wiping it off his face, he humps the Canadian flag. doing absolutely everything you can do just to be a disgusting human being towards the fans, and obviously creating that heat. And then obviously Brett the Hero comes out to his hometown fans, and or well, home country fans, should I say, and the match is off. It starts off, I mean, a quick pace of just punches. They're trading leather. Obviously, Michaels, again, because, you know, the two of these guys had such an amazing chemistry together. Michaels eventually takes the very, very solid bumps to each punch. He's down, he's up, boom, boom, boom. He's up, he's selling for Brett properly, because he probably knows that if he doesn't, he might get hurt. But no, the consummate professionals between the two of them. And then obviously the match spills out. One of the things I noticed in this match when it spills out to the crowd, very realistic looking, very similar. I guess you might agree, lads, very similar to the work that Brett done with Austin actually at WrestleMania 13.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So this is something obviously that Brett has in his repertoire, that he's able to kind of tell that story of, like, let's really tell a story here of the hate that we have for each other. They spend a good 12 minutes before the bell rings even. Go ahead, Carl.
I think I was just gonna say you can tell in the likes of that match, the match
with Austin. Hawk.
Yeah. These guys were well able. They were at the same level as each other. Now if Brett was with someone who wasn't up to his level, you'd notice him doing all the work. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was almost like they were competing with each other to outdo each other, which made for a better match, a tighter match all around, I feel. But just in general, with top workers, you know.
No, that's a good. And that's a really good point. I agree with that. Yeah, exactly.
And that match was no exception. Like,
same with Sean. Like, you can always tell when Sean is kind of leading the way. Sean shows his frustration a little bit more because he tends to kick big lads in the head and stuff like that. But no, in fairness, Sean, you can always see that as well when Sean's leading the way. What about you two guys, Niall and Jay? When you look back on that match, just for what it is, before we get into the, I suppose, gravy.
Yeah, well, like I said earlier, I think like the match itself and the build up and all had everything that you'd want. You know, it was like Montreal, it was Brett, it was the belt, it was Sean, it was, you know, and Sean always, those build ups, he always hammed it up to, like, he turned it up a notch. You know what I mean? And especially with it being Brett, he was gonna turn it way up a notch. You know what I mean? So like the match itself, the back and forth in the match and stuff like that, and the chemistry between them, you know, there's no secret the chemistry that they had, you know.
It was unbelievable, yeah.
And the thing about it as well is they weren't too dissimilar at that time in the way that they wrestled and the way that they approached it.
No.
You know what I mean? I would have said at the time probably Brett was a bit more technical. But I would have said Sean kind of made up for that with his athleticism and his sort of his charisma and all that type of stuff, you know what I mean? So
his in ring charisma, yeah, for sure. His ring, I mean, yeah. neither guy, to be fair, was actually ever great on the mic. Sean was great at looking like a prick of a heel. He played he out doing the dancing, say things that would annoy you. Brett was, you know, the generic good guy who could just I'll see you out in the ring and blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Whereas...
But Sean found it very easy to rub fans up the wrong way and stuff like that.
There you go.
So if you think about the build-up to that match and before it kicked off, I mean, he would have... That stuff he was dealing with the Canadian fans and all that night, like, that's easy work for him. Easy work.
It came natural to him.
Because he rubbed a lot of people up the wrong way anyway, even in reality. So imagine if you're going out there hammering up and, like, you know, what you're doing to the national flag and everything else and all, you know. And then we know how passionate Canadian fans are about sport in general, near alone pro wrestling. I mean, we've seen in the past, like, fans attacking Jericho outside buildings and everything and all for how good he's been as a... And so there's no doubt that these fans were buying in, and Brett was a national treasure and a national hero. There's no doubt about it. And, like, they just saying Sean has been... You know, this spoiled sort of brat coming up through the ranks who was just going to try and have his way with Brett, really. And the fans were having none of it.
That's a good little segue, Jay, because we've talked about this actually. And I've actually heard Stone Cold Steve Austin talk about this as well recently. And a couple of big names. I've heard Jim Cornette, Uncle Jim, as Jay and Carol call him.
Uncle Jim.
Uncle James E. And And I've also heard Jim Ross talk about this as well. So this is a lot of high praise. They were saying, you know, when people talked about Brett Hart on the microphone, I think it's actually probably fair to say that Brett as a heel is a different animal on the microphone than Brett as a babyface. And I think this was the year that we mentioned, 1997. If you want to really go back and look at some of the best promo work in wrestling in general, it was during that year. I mean, it's all on the network. Yeah. People can go back and look at it. There was never bad promos when the Hart Foundation were coming out, whether they were shouting out against the Nation of Domination, whether they were shouting out against America and Americans being bad. It's funny that, like, obviously, they were calling stuff out that's happening in America now. And, yeah. You know, this is 97. But they were, you know, and they made basically the American fans and America the villains, and then made themselves baby faces all around the world. But
yeah,
really,
that was one of my favorite things of this whole feud and between the two factions was that they were the Hart Foundation with the heels in the U.S., but everywhere else they were the faces. You know, and you couldn't have got a better twist on it. Like, you really couldn't. It was fascinating to watch. I thought it was.
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah,
but you have to remember in that period as well, you had a lot of people up in arms around the world because the US was just going around trying to dominate the world globally and everything and all. Yeah. You know, so.
But Jay, you
know, there was a lot of aftermaths of war and.
Well, even from a business perspective, you it's interesting when you talk about eras and blocks of time in regards to professional wrestling and what is viewed as, we'll say, aspects of work, be it physical, be it psychological, be it promo work. I mean, from my memory, from my times growing up, this traditional babyface heel war was always slightly muddied when it came to certain men. I mean, like you said, Sean was, you know, him and Marty were the fucking your cookie cutter, you know, good guy fucking baby faces. They were always high flying, bright colors. The women loved them. The kids wanted to fucking beat them. And then you take a look at Brett with his career with Anvil. To say he wasn't so great or hot on the mic is unfair to him in the respect that in that era, it kind of depended who you were, where your program was, and who you were running against as to determine whether or not you were babyface or heel. Like, more often than not, you look at old Hart Foundation matches, you couldn't really tell whether they were babyface or heel now. They mightn't have got much stick time, but whether they were against Demolition or whether they were fucking running around in the blue and black, it was it was muddy. They weren't so clear cut all the way through their career. And even with Brett, he could pull on each set of shoes equally when he walked out between the fucking curtains, and he's the perfect territory worker in a sense that other men floated around territories, whereas Brett was raised in his father's in Stampede, and when he went to American television, there was always that flag divide. One of the oldest gimmicks wrestlers used in that era of television to denote whether or not they were babyface or heel was what fucking cloth they were holding. You know,
He was also booked very cleverly as well, because they always booked Brett against Goyas, who always gave him plenty of material to use in promos.
You know what I mean?
So, like, it was like nearly they gave him, like, you know, when they booked him against Austin and stuff like that, you know, he got tons of promo material. So it was easy for him to put it out there.
You know what I mean?
There didn't have to be a whole lot in it, really, you know?
No, not at all. And again, that's a mark of him as a psychological wrestler. He could almost. He could do things instinctively that other men couldn't do simply because they were still on the path to learning. Like, Shawn Michaels was still a fucking amateur in the ways of working a big crowd. He didn't have 17 fucking monikers. He wasn't the showstopper, Mr. WrestleMania, the Heartbreak Kid. He was on the way to being that. Whereas Bret Hart, from the time he was taken off the tip, was a worker. Do you know what I mean? He was his father's son, and he's the last of that classic territory style of wrestler. Even though he was young and he was dynamic, he could decide in the ring what he had to be that night in front of the fucking crowd. Whereas most men read the script and go, this is what's needed of me. Whereas with Brett, it was always give or take. Yeah. Like, he could go either way.
That's a really good point you make there, Jay, because I was actually reading an article recently from an interview with Brett from a while back, and it was great to read. It was just literally about the upbringing in the Stampede territory.
Yeah.
And what the question that was posed to him was, what did he think that separated himself and Owen, and even separate himself and Owen from the rest of the pack. And he said it, he goes, look, my brothers were all, you know, raised in the business the same way. He said, but the difference was, because he was that little bit younger, he was sitting in the front row, you know, looking at Archie the Stomper, you know, at 3 and 4 years old, and literally trying to study what they were doing, because he was in that, he was learning, he was looking at the boys practicing and understanding, okay, these boys aren't really hitting each other. So he was obviously deciphering in that little child brain of how these guys are doing it and how they're telling the story. And then obviously I think Dynamite comes over and really helps. I mean, there's a guy that needs to be mentioned a lot more, and we do mention him quite a lot. I'm sure we will talk about the Bulldogs one day on the show. But I think when you talk about Dynamite in terms of actually working programs with Brett, in terms of bringing that style over, it kind of showed, you could see a lot of Dynamite's work in Brett's work in the ring too. And I think that's what separated him from, say, some of the brothers too, in terms of style. When he got to the WWE, he was able to bring some of that more dynamic Japan, UK based kind of stuff. There was some, you know, he used a lot of European uppercuts, side rush and leg sweeps, even elbow drops from the second row in the 80s was still a big deal, right? But isn't it amazing to see?
Yeah. Isn't it amazing to see as well that, like, a lot of those guys that have come down from Canada have that kind of trait where they can work on the fly and change and adapt to an audience and stuff like that? Because you see it with Edge, you see it with Jericho.
Yeah.
We kind of seen it with Benoit.
We used to see it with Jericho.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like he has that ability to adapt on the fly in matches and stuff like that and all.
Yeah, now he has the ability to rub himself in orange.
You still can't take his past away from him.
No, I'm only kidding.
No matter what he swims in and for how much he's taking.
I'm literally stirring that pot of orange now, trying to get someone to come out.
Mimosa.
Mimosa. Listen, you know I'm a Jericho mark. I'll always be a Jericho mark. But
everybody is. You can't be a wrestling fan and not respect Jericho's work.
But it's true. I think there's a difference, because in America, you probably had, if you think about it, in the United States, every single city probably had a wrestling school with some fat little fuck who was sitting there just taking their money, saying that, oh, well, I used to know fucking Killer Kowalski and he showed me this, so give me $3,000 and I'll teach you how to wrestle. And he would get his first student who possibly had been in the ring once or twice and knows how to do a couple of wrist locks to teach you a few bumps. We've seen it in with that fat motherfucker in Beyond the Mat. Remember that fat guy? Oh, $3,000, and he had your man.
Yeah.
Those sort of guys were to a penny. Whereas in Canada, to go back to Niall's point, you had your territories. In Calgary, you knew there was one place that you learned to wrestle if you wanted to wrestle. You had obviously in Montreal, you had the Duprees, and then you obviously had the Rougeaus as well. So there was a couple of places
The interesting thing about the Hart boys is there's never been an instance in the televised era of professional wrestling where you had royalty. Like, every other man had to crawl on his hands and knees and do all the fucking skivvy jobs and do all the bullshit. The pressure of success destroyed Stu Hart's family. Mm-hmm. What we've got and what is left is the remnants of what it was in 97. Like, you're talking about fucking wrestling royalty, and Brett himself is the prince. He's the prince heir apparent. He nobody got it like him from a work perspective. Like, he was just it was like a second language to him. It was probably his first fucking language. Do you know what I mean? He was just, who else had that? Who else? Shawn Michaels got the shit beat out of him up and down corridors for fucking 6 years touring with Marty Jannetty because Marty couldn't handle his drink and drugs. Bret Hart, from the time he could lace up his own fucking boots, was a marquee headliner in a country where his father was the fucking Vince McMahon before a Vince McMahon character even existed.
Yeah.
He's an oddity.
Benoit is probably the closest, is he?
To what?
In terms of that comparison. In terms of work rate and in terms of, you know, coming up through those ranks and stuff like that.
I would say Eddie Guerrero. I would be more inclined to think Eddie Guerrero, because of obviously the family, again, the family tree. If you look at the Guerrero family tree, it's not too dissimilar.
But the Mexican and the Lucha style is still almost looked down upon from the classic American style.
I think Eddie was able to bring that and take it to, you know, take both and make them both pretty much, you know, he was,
but Eddie never had to, or Brett never had to do a fucking stint in ECW from the time when Vince was gifted Brett. Brett was on the top of the fucking heap. Nobody else.
That's fair.
I'm not taking anything away from these men who had the hard slog. They were incredible. But
Randy Orton then would be the next one in line, then, surely, right?
Randy, most certainly.
Randy would be the guy then, yeah. if that's the point that you're making.
Third generation. Yeah.
Randy would be the guy.
And also, it backed up by the fact that Randy is probably the most natural and fluid of that style on the planet.
In the history, whatever.
I mean, nobody ever talks about how his title runs and how his gift of the crown is almost running fucking parallel with John Goddamn Cena and Ric Flair. But he sits in the back seat. He could have had a hell of a lot more. There's times when Randy just switches off the fucking switch and sits back for 2 years and goes, I'm happy earning and smoking weed with my beautiful wife. Who gives a fuck? Mm. He in himself is unique, but...
Yeah. But when he turns it on, Jesus.
I'm a fan.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a fan, and I agree with you there, Jay. You pretty much summed up Randy Orton. I know we probably will talk about people like Randy Orton in the show. We definitely will. I mean, Randy Orton
will.
Is on podcast.
How could you talk? Look how young he is.
But, yeah, so, I mean, we've kind of established that. So let's talk a bit more about Sean then. So his journey's a little bit different. So Sean obviously comes up. He's down in San Antonio. Again, learning kind of some of the lucha style with Jose Lothario. Jose Lothario has a lot of respect and then hasn't a lot of respect from certain people either, including Brett. Look,
bless him. Sean was still paying fucking $10 a week to learn off the bottom of the fucking rung. Like, the person that Sean became is probably because of how hard his route to the top was. I mean, like I said, one's gifted the silver spoon and the crown and go to America, bring the Stampede crown and make us proud. Whereas Shawn Michaels, like I said, is helping Marty find the drugs that he dropped. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I know when you're saying that, Jay, you're not saying that to take away from Brett. You're saying it just more.
No, nobody chooses how they get there.
Yeah,
Brett made the most of it. Brett wasn't gifted something that he didn't already have. There's other hearts who weren't as successful as him at that particular style for that length of time in several different fucking companies, two or three companies at least.
So I think when I think of Shawn Michaels myself, okay, because obviously people, I know there's people now literally getting off the treadmill because they're going to go, oh, here comes Dynamo, he's going to rip into Shawn. It's actually quite the opposite. When I was a kid, Shawn Michaels was someone that was pretty much next in line for me as my second favorite before this whole feud started, especially like 94, 95, you know what I mean? A big fan. I can see Jay there talking to someone who I know well, who's here listening. And I
do you hear what he's saying?
Yep, 100%. Speaking very highly of Shawn Michaels. And the thing is, like, 94, 95, Shawn Michaels, again, was literally up there with Brett for me as the next in line for me as my kind of, you know, other guy that I enjoyed watching more than anybody else, to be fair. Along with Stinger, I have to say, I was a WCW mark as well. I was always a big Sting mark. I was the kid still watching UTV, WCW.
Unless they're Blade Runner.
Oh, I'm telling you. but... It's funny because you look at Sean's journey I think Carl made the point there, and I actually do agree with him, and I think a lot of people nowadays, it's kind of folklore that Brett and Sean had this completely different style, and that's what made them. Not really. Sean was not an out-and-out high-flyer wrestler. He had a lot more high-flying moves within his arsenal, but he wasn't. I mean, Dynamite Kid is a high-flyer. You know, Eddie Guerrero had more high-flying than Sean was actually still very, very ground-based. He had a lot of strikes, a lot of punches, and a lot of rest holds. And when I say rest holds, he could, as a heel, he could kind of frustrate you to get the baby face over too. I'm sure we'd all agree with that, especially when he had a bit more meat than when he was knocking around with Sherry, which was actually my favorite version of Shawn Michaels, to be honest with you.
Good hell, Sherry.
When he had the mirror and he'd be looking, taking the glasses off. SummerSlam 1992. Here's the perfect one. Bret Hart was wrestling in the main event against British Bulldog in possibly one of the greatest professional wrestling matches of all time. But at the same time on that card, one of the most entertaining matches of all time was Shawn Michaels and Rick Martel in a blindfold match. They didn't even blindfold. There was no touching of the face. That was the whole idea. It wasn't a blindfold match. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no face.
There was no hitting in the face. And I mean, that was just stuff that was way ahead of its time. Characters that were able to, not even ahead of its time. I mean, they were probably all doing stuff like that, you know, back in the territory days, but on a national scale. Yeah. So when you watch Shawn's growth, Shawn was grown within the WWE. I know exactly what Jay is saying. Brett had kind of learned his art in Calgary.
It was in his blood. Yeah.
Shawn was learning on the job. Yeah. And you could see what way it went. And then you watch the two of them actually meet, which is a little known gem for people if they haven't watched it. Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels in Survivor Series 1992, which is amazing. 5 years later, it all comes to an end. Survivor Series 92, Bret and Shawn is an absolutely phenomenal match for anybody that hasn't seen it. Go and check it out. But Noel, what would you... You've been quiet there, and Carl, you can kind of jump in now and kind of throw some knowledge on this mother...
Well, I wanted to say, I know it's just to do with the feud anyway, but could you honestly say in today's product that you'd watch an Iron Man match, a full hour, and be really invested in it?
I did 2 weeks ago. I watched the NXT one with the four brothers. He was Adam Cole.
There was fucking 18 of them in it, wasn't there?
Sorry?
There was about 18 in the fucking ring that
no,
time, wasn't there?
No, there was four of them. There was Finn Balor.
Yeah, 18.
Adam Cole. Yeah, it was decent. It was a decent attempt. But Carl, I do agree with your point. In a one-on-one straightener, no, absolutely not.
The point I'm trying to make is, and even that NXT match was rushed. There wasn't a real big build to it. Whereas the storytelling with this rivalry was just... unparalleled, as you said, except for when it was Bret and Stone Cold, you know?
Yeah.
So, everything that these lads did together was just, and you know me, I'm a stickler for believability. You don't want to believe that what they're doing. Like, I mean, and that's why I love Randy Orton so much. Believe that he'd kick the shit out of you.
Yeah.
You would believe it, you know?
I don't know, just that match that Ian brought up there, the was it Balor, Adam Cole? I mean, that seemed like, that was quite a believable match as well, you know. Those guys did a sterling job on that, in fairness, you know. Considering it's in the current time, you know what I mean?
Where every
fan now knows basically everything. They literally know what these guys have had for their breakfast the morning of a pay-per-view. You know what I mean? So, like, I think they still did an excellent job, you know. I get your point that it's hard to invest in an Iron Man match. But then, you know, the way wrestling has gone, it's hard to invest in a three-hour show.
Very true. Very true.
No, so that's kind of part of it as well. And I think what happened is, as a society, we've gotten so distracted now because we've so much on offer now that, like, we get distracted so quickly that if you can keep us for 20 minutes to a half an hour, you're doing well.
That's the problem there.
Uncle Jim said that recently, that obviously the segue from that our match was the next week, obviously, with Adam Cole and Finn Balor. And to be honest with you, I've watched that match twice now, and that is without a doubt the best professional wrestling match in the last, easily in the last 5 to 6 years, without a shadow of a doubt.
But I mean, there you go, they're top guys of their generation.
But that's
you know, the Adam Cole is amazing. Look at the match he had with McAfee. Ah, oh, he's brilliant.
Well, so is Finn Balor.
I'm just saying, like, he brought Pat McAfee into a match, and he, like, in fairness, Pat McAfee did as good as he did a great job, you know. But the
Shout
point
out
I'm trying to make
Pat
is,
McAfee, actually. Yeah.
But the point I'm trying to make is Adam Cole is like they almost compare him to Shawn Michaels, you know.
Listen,
to a point.
I'm sorry, Adam Cole isn't better than Finn Balor. That's just, and I know there's going to be bias here, but you can do that all you want, but
gentlemen, there's a different set of parameters there as well, though. When you go and try and do it at the big show, they tell you, here's your script and a cue, I want you to do this, and then you work for 5 minutes between you, and then there's a second cue and I need you to do this. Whereas down in NXT, you're working with two men who are like, I trust you, go in there, sell it to me, do this fucking match. This is the only way you're getting out of this. Yeah. Sell it. Make the company upstairs want you. And that doesn't happen on the big shows anymore. You're so scripted that you're not allowed to let your own natural character develop and morph into the assignment you've been given. The thing with Sean and Brett was, we watched these men as fucking children in the ring develop into the personalities that they were. And the point made by Carl earlier on is the reason that the hour long was so compelling is because we were watching Sean versus Brett, not spot versus spot and style versus style. You've got to believe in the character who's in the ring. Yeah. This isn't EastEnders. This is sell it to me as a fan. Don't expect me to want you to do your script correctly. Like, we could be missing out on thousands of hours of fucking brilliant wrestling simply because these young men aren't allowed to spend 5 years develop who they're going to be and let us culminate in these big super matches. There's like, we're watching them chasing one or two decent feuds over the course of a year as opposed to a whole talent roster filling 3 hours full of fucking viable entertainment.
You know what's also an interesting argument at the moment. People are talking at the moment about wrestling with fans and wrestling without fans. If there was ever a period in wrestling that showed how important fans were to the product, you know, that was that period, and that time was amazing. The fan base was crazy.
Yes, rabid for who they fucking supported. Rabid for them in the ring.
Yeah. I agree, Carl. You know what I mean? That was a great point by you, Carl, to be fair. It was actually a good point. I know we brought up, obviously, today it is a little bit different, and I do agree with Jay, and I was just trying to literally make the point that, you know, you've got guys like, you know, Adam Cole, Balor, Tommaso Ciampa, that are well capable of doing that. And I do hear exactly what you're saying, and I know that it's a completely different time and it's not the same.
I'm not taking that away from those lads, obviously, because I love those lads as well.
Yeah. No, but I guess the point that Jay is making, and I suppose I could probably, you know, touch on it just a little bit, is a lot of these guys now are on guaranteed contracts. These matches, these WrestleMania moments for the likes of Brett and Sean to be able to pull off an hour-long match, in a lot of ways was do or die, because he still knew he had Taker there and many big men in the wing. We just put the belt back on Diesel, and we'll make Diesel and Taker the main event next year, because obviously fans don't want to see two small men wrestle. You know, it was the first hour long match since the Territory Broadway days of, you know, the Steamboat and Flair hour long Donnybrook and the, you know, the Harley Race and Flair Donnybrooks. But the difference here is it wasn't an hour full of rest holes. Because as much as I love Ric Flair, one of the greatest of all time, for sure, woo, all that kind of thing. Once you've seen a Ric Flair match, you've seen them all, because there's only so many times he can do a shtick in those matches against a Harley Race or against a Steamboat. Steamboat and Harley Race always had different ways to kind of, you know, change up the match a little bit on the spot and stuff like that. And that's actually what made Ric Flair too. People need to remember that when we talk about Ric Flair, which again, he'll have his own show for sure. But those hour-long matches, the point I'm trying to make is that Flair was dependent as much on his own stamina as his opponent to change it up a little bit so it didn't become the same thing. Because Flair almost admits himself at times that that's all he knew. Do you know what I mean? Whereas Steamboat could just change something up. Steamboat's in the kind of Dynamite Kid section where you can just go, you know what? I'm going to put you up on the top rope. I'm going to try a gut wrench suplex from the top rope here just to change it up. Fuck it. Let's go.
I think just before you go on there, sorry, just to touch with Ric Flair, I think Ric Flair was more like a 54% promo, 45%, and that's not taking that away from his in-ring ability.
I don't think like so.
He took... You knew it was a Ric Flair promo, and then all the other stuff was kind of secondary. You know what I mean? That's just my take on Flair, for example. Just to put in there.
But you know, the aspect of that is Flair made it great when not everything was on television, and you traveled with that same match from down to town. Once you've seen it, look, you can't do it 15 times in a row, especially not with different workers every 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
It's about era and time. And again, exactly. Like I said, the most important thing with pro wrestling is parameters. What you've got to work with is how well you can do with it. Those, we're talking about men who were trusted at the gorilla position to go out there and work with somebody who had reached the level where they already knew, right, we've never wrestled before, but I already know you came through 3 territories in 15 fucking years. I knew everybody you worked with. I've fucked every bird you have on the road. We're going to go out here and I trust you with my body. Whereas now, they hit gorilla position and there's 14 fucking writers there. And it's like, well, we don't want you to get over tonight because we've already got 3 men over rope for the next 4 years. So just go out there and do an adequate match, but still make it interesting, but don't be brilliant. Mm-hmm. And how can you stop somebody who's brilliant from being brilliant? Perfect example in that, like, is your man fucking woo-woo-woo. Your man who's in
AEW. Matt, whatever his name is.
Whatever his name
Black
is.
Black Ryder.
Yeah, him,
right?
Zack Ryder,
yeah.
The only reason that he got chewed out and sent down basically is because he went out of his way to get himself over when he was told by the boss, get over whatever way you can. And then when he did get over, it was like, well, we're going to have to undo 2 years of story writing and fire a load of people and get a load of new stories wrote because you went and got over when you weren't supposed to. What did you do that for? Do you know what I mean?
Well, the difference with him is he ended up getting over when they had let him go. Because he just created this wave of YouTube hysteria and they brought him back.
Yeah. But he's actually back to sell t-shirts, not to wrestle.
Matt Cardona. But Matt Cardona is a great wrestler and a great worker too. And obviously,
we never seen it in WWE.
And it's funny. And that's the thing. You know what I mean? He lives for wrestling. But look, I know where we're headed there. Obviously headed towards one person that makes these decisions here, and he will have his own podcast one day, but he does rear his face.
He has all
on this show too, and that is Vinnie Mac.
Yeah,
because that's essentially who we're all blaming it on, and that is essentially the truth. It is Vinnie Mac's fault, but he still.
Well, I think you probably have to break it down. Like, if you look in terms of the screw job, are we Team Sean? Are we Team Brett? Are we somewhere in between? Like, how do we feel about what unfolded?
Well, let's
all roads lead to Vince.
Well, I suppose I'm the narrator here, so I'll let you guys decide on this one. So I suppose that's a good one, Carl. Or sorry, Niall. You're bringing us back to the journey,
back on the tracks,
on the road,
back to the topic.
this is what we do. We segue.
Hey,
here.
Wait,
we could do the history of Jim Crocker Promotions next week.
This is what we do. We segue, man.
It all matters. These characters who are in this next
matter. If people want to listen to just story time and a Ladybird book, well then they can go and buy one and fuck off and don't listen to the show. That's very simple. That would be my advice to them. If you want to hear some segueing and some wrestling knowledge, then stay on tracks with us. If not, like I said, I'm not going to lose sleep. It's all good. But the way, I suppose, to kind of premise this there, Niall, would be, obviously, in the build-up, right, we know that, you know, it's obviously all come out now because there is documentaries now. I believe the one that was the one that JR kind of mediated. JR mediated that documentary with Sean, where
the greatest rivalry.
Yeah, and the smell of lies off Shawn Michaels in that whole show, because every time Brett said you did this, and Sean was like, "Oh well, I must have done it, but I don't recall." Do you remember you done this, Sean? Oh well, I must have done
Sean
it.
Sean was trying to set up for another match.
Yeah. But, you know, you could tell that Sean, even though he found God, still couldn't find it within his soul.
Bitter remember, the high forget.
You what?
I said the bitter remember, but the high forget. You know what I mean?
No, I don't know about that. I think I think the scum lie is also. That's the difference. He's no more found God He's no more found God than I have. And I'm very holy.
Fact.
Only in religion.
Only in religion, baby. Only in religion. But no, it's funny, right? Shout out to all the God-loving people out there, too. We love you, too. It's all good.
Your God is dead.
You can keep listening. But no.
On our Patreon.
On our Patreon only. We have a special mass for all of you people on our Patreon.
And we've got a collection.
Mass with DJ Road Dogg. It's his first introduction.
We'll dig out a collection basket.
Yeah, we're gonna have to but no, so obviously the two sides of the story to break this one down is obviously and this is where Jay is gonna really, really kind of shine in a while. But so Sean, obviously, it's not really Sean's problem whether Brett's there or not. I don't think Sean wants Brett out or anything. I think it's just a case of they don't like each other and that's it or whatever. He likes antagonizing people. That's it. He's high on all kinds of fucking free pharmaceutical drugs. He's just loving life at the time.
He's also an unsafe work environment.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they get into a little fight and he cries then because, you know, he doesn't like fights. But he calls it an unsafe work environment.
The hair was pulled out of his head. He wasn't wrong, in fairness, was he?
Well, listen, to be fair, Jay, it doesn't really matter. Brett had hair too. He could have pulled back. He just didn't know what to do. It wasn't like Carol King was in a fight with you and he pulled your hair.
Ooh.
And you had no opportunity to pull his.
Ooh, hair versus hair match.
I'd recommend in that scenario, pull the beard. Always go for the beard.
But it's kind of like knowing what you know now and that a lot of the factual stuff has come out. I mean, what's your interpretation of it or how do you feel about it? And now that we, you know, it's all come full circle, more or less.
I'll start. I think Brett was obviously still, you know, the reason that never went to court, figuratively, was because obviously there was an ironclad contract given there that Brett obviously had creative control of the last 30 days of his contract and they had agreed, obviously, that he was going to leave the company within that 30 days. So therefore, Brett said, look, I'm not dropping the belt to Sean. It's come out, obviously, in recent times that Brett went up to Sean and said, look, now that I'm leaving, I just want you to know. It's all water under the bridge. I'd be happy to, you know, put you over once again. And Sean, in his fucking infancy, says, well, I wouldn't do the same for you. So Brett said, fuck you. I'm not going to bother doing that for you then. You know, and that's fair. So Brett said, fuck you.
He was honest.
Yeah. Yeah, he was honest, and Brett said that. But Brett then said, well, I'm going to be honest too. I'm not going to do anything for you either. So fuck you. So it was two spoiled children, basically, fighting over, you know, well, he said this first, Vince, and he said that. And sure, Vince, if you could write it down, it was like cartoon time with Vince, just getting phone calls. You want to hear what he said today, Vince? Do you want to hear what he said today, Vince? So, you know, I'm sure if Brett could have had his way, he probably would have just looked absolutely boxed the head off Sean and that be that, but obviously they have to work and do business. So obviously the creative control aspect, I think, goes unnoticed when people are talking about this because contracts are ironclad, especially when there's millions of dollars involved. It's usually the scrotes that don't know anything about contracts that usually go, oh, well, that doesn't matter. Like, okay, the only contract you've ever had was fucking, what, like, you know, 10 hours in fucking juvie. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, but I suppose those contracts are one thing until paranoia kicks in.
Well, no, well, paranoia was rightly, paranoia was definitely prevailed on this one because whatever paranoia Brett had, it came true. So again, it's only paranoia because it's like the old conspiracy thing. You know, people like to throw out the word conspiracy theory at someone that makes a theory. Sometimes it could be true, though. You never know. And it's the same with paranoia, you know? Oh, you're paranoid. Yeah. Oh, so you're not talking about me. I know we are. We're just fucking with you. You know, so it's kind of one of those things. I don't know. I'm always going to be on Team Brett in that aspect.
No shit.
I think he was right. I do think there was other ways that they could have done it. It wasn't like they didn't create a different scenario that once they got back to the States, he could drop it to someone else. I don't think there was ever a fear. And Vince knows this. There was never a fear of Brett dropping the belt in the trash like Alundra Blaze did. Let's be fair. Brett wasn't that kind of guy. He wasn't that kind of professional. And I think that's just a silly narrative that gets thrown out there to kind of defend their actions. But that's just where I stand on it. King Wall has muted himself there and he's talking.
Sorry. Didn't Undertaker offer to take the title?
Yes, that's correct.
Or to lose the title or whatever it was. But he offered a way out.
Yeah. He said he'd be so Brett. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, they could have even put him into the mix as a triple threat, like, you know.
Yeah.
But no. So, he's like, I'm
Vince wanted his bum boy to be the new champion because whatever sexual relationship they had going on behind the scenes was...
Moderator, try to remain impartial.
Oh, sorry. I thought it was muted like the woe there.
He just said he wanted to get off his chest in silence. He's working the paranoia.
I'm feeling a lot better now that I didn't... you didn't hear what I was saying.
You weren't wrong.
I know. So yeah, that, well, there's me and the woe. So I guess it's only the shopkeeper and the DJ now.
Well,
that's your new name.
We'll take it, but I'm gonna leave my personal theories for a moment.
Still after, because... exactly. So Noel, you have to come in here.
Well, I always go with the view who whoever writes me check, that's the guy who I do the work for. You know, and I just leave it at that, like, you know what I mean? I'm not going to get into, like, you know what I mean? When I hear that lads won't do jobs in certain geographical locations, it just makes me sick and I just can't listen to it, you know what I mean? So I was there, like, I was sort of like, I think all parties involved were riddled with paranoia, and I can understand why it happened. I don't like the fact that it happened, but I can understand why it happened. But if the guy in the office who writes my check is the guy telling me this is what needs to be done because of this, and I'm sure Vince McMahon in a conversation in an office can be very convincing.
So you're one of these guys again that doesn't believe in contracts then. So you've literally glossed over the fact that I mentioned there was an ironclad contract.
No, I'm one of those guys who does believe in the contract, because I'm saying the guy who writes my check is the guy who I do the work for. So yeah, I'm totally in on contracts.
But Brett was guaranteed to be paid and he had creative control, so that kind of nullifies that, really.
Yeah, but you know, it started like and the fact that he wanted.
Anyway.
But the fact that he wanted creative control for the last 30 days as well, you know what I mean?
Well, it turns out That paranoia was rightly so put in, right?
I think he was covering himself there.
Hell, and rightly so. No, I was only trying to wind this up anyway, but here comes probably, guys, I would say this is, without a shadow of a doubt, a step off the treadmill moment. Because Jay has a theory on this, which, to be honest with you, it's not, you know, call it a conspiracy theory if you want. There's been many made about the Montreal Screwjob. However, this happens to be probably the best one that I've heard so far. Probably one that makes the most sense as well, considering lots of people that were obviously there at the time don't believe that it was a real thing. They believe that was a work. And I think that this theory probably lends a lot of credence to that. So our new member of the Four Podmen is literally about to become the star of the Four Podmen.
I'm just going to put my tinfoil hat on here. Go ahead.
The floor is yours, Jason Kennedy.
Bombshell tonight. Right. Look, I spent a lot of time watching and reviewing and listening to podcasts and knowing what I know about the situation and knowing what I know about many situations. And to be perfectly honest, in a nutshell, what it's led me to believe is one thing. It was absolutely a work. Now, where the work comes in is the nature of the work itself. What I think was, Brett was up to his balls in money that Vince paid him, that Vince couldn't afford to pay him. Vince needed an out of a situation to, one, keep his company afloat at a time when he was probably a little worried about the situation, and two, he needed to appease all parties in the situation. I think he basically sat down with Bret Hart behind closed doors and said, look, this is how it's going to go. We're going to use an aspect we used an awful long time ago. We're going to do a screw job. Only me and you know about it. Everybody outside there doesn't know about it. And the only reason I'm bringing this to you and your table is because I signed you to a contract that I can't afford to pay right now. But you've been a good servant and soldier for the last 15 fucking years for me. And I'm going to put something in your pocket to walk away with that will, one, continue to be an income for you for the next 25, 30, 40, 50, 60 fucking years. And two, sort out my particular situation in several different aspects. One, you get to take that contract that I can't match. Two, I get to somewhat retain a little bit of my dignity as a man of his word who's dealt with handshakes for the last 15 fucking years. We appease Sean. And here's what we're going to do. And I think he laid down the groundwork for the last great work of the 20th century. I think that was pretty much what happened. He turned around, laid it out to Brett, and said, this work has to be absolute. It's between you and me and nobody fucking else. Nobody else knows about it. And then from there on in, I think what played out is what he laid out. I think he, true to his word, found a way, one, to let Brett go off to WCW, two, appease Sean and his covetous greed and his need and his sticky little fucking hands for a belt around his waist and his king of the hill, top of the heap, crown on his head, three, whilst also being able to maintain a contract with the boss that the boss could afford, and four, setting up, like I said, the last great work of the old era, that golden age, that golden era. And that's pretty much what I think happened. And I think all of the evidence of the situation pretty much points to that. I mean, when H and the likes say they didn't know what happened, I believe them. I don't think Taker knew what happened. I think there was anybody who was going to know what was going to happen, it would have been Taker on the inside. I think the whole shit where he went in and punched Brett, quotation marks, I think that all happened behind closed doors while Brett was wearing a mic to a documentary that he was filming at the same time, purely as a fucking angle to the whole thing. I think it's literally the last great caper of pro wrestling before we entered into this isn't it internet style of modern contemporary wrestling, I suppose. It was the birth of the Attitude Era, the Montreal Screwjob, but it was also the death of the Golden Era. Now, there's plenty of evidence to fucking substantiate what I'm saying. I only recently found out, apparently, Vince and Brett met in secret in some fucking park in Canada in the year 2000 or some shit like that.
That's true. That's 100% true, yeah.
Like, I mean, again, I didn't know about this before. This is only something I found out the other day, which kind of substantiates my particular theory on the whole work. I don't think Sean knew. I don't think he would let Sean in on the secret simply because of who he was at the time. He was a fella who couldn't drop a belt cleanly. He was up to the fucking eyeballs on drugs. There's not a hope in hell a man who runs a company like that over 15 years doesn't know what's happening in his locker room. Anybody who's anybody knows what Sean was like back then. You know, all of his mates were pretty much in the same shit too, with the exception of H. I think there was two last great works. I think the curtain call was one of them, which was less significant. But again, it was the start of the kind of WCW-WWF war, if you will. Mm. And there's one thing about Vince, when he goes to war, he goes to win.
And it's funny, Jay, just to kind of, I suppose, that something that could, because you mentioned there that about Sean's buddies, obviously, two of them obviously being Nash and Hall. Obviously, I think Nash was never really an alcoholic, obviously, because he was a very smart man.
No, money was his drug.
Yeah, but I did see a Shoot interview after this theory and after you put this forward to me. I looked back on some Shoot interviews of the boys talking, and I typed in Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, Shoot interviews, and that was actually something that came up, and both of them believe it was work. Kevin Nash comes up with something quite simple. He goes, there's no way Brett and Vince didn't have a chat. There's no way Brett and Vince didn't have a chat. So that kind of tells me that they know that Brett and Vince had some sort of relationship, because it was, Brett always said it was like a father and son relationship, right? You know, so.
I wonder, did Brett and Vince have a chat about it? And I wonder, did they not come to an agreement on it? Because I think if you think of Bret Hart, and you think of Bret Hart, the man, the human being, and all that sort of stuff, do you really think he'd buy into the longevity of a work like that and stuff like that? And really, like,
he was raised in the territories.
He was, but he was also, like, if you think about it, he was also raised to be that guy. If you think about Bret Hart is all about the legacy of Bret Hart, the career and all that. If you look at Bret Hart's career journey, if you think if that conversation did happen and that setup did happen, like, you know, there's a lot of tarnishing there as well on both sides. You know what I mean? When you think about it, you know what I mean? So, I just can't imagine. I can't imagine a conversation with Bret Hart and with Vince. I understand where you're coming from, but I can't imagine a conversation like that where Bret would turn around and go, Yeah, that's no problem. But look at the amount of money he left on the table after that then, because he disappeared basically, for, apart from WCW, but he disappeared out of the business for what, 20 years?
Yeah, but
he got super kicked to the head.
Yeah,
he was always going to come home.
The plan was... Jay made a really good point on that there, because Noel, I thought about this, because they're good questions. They were questions that I asked as a Bret Hart, you know, fan. When Jay posed this to me initially, and I thought about it, I was like, Vince is saying, you're going to go and you're going to make $3 million a year on a five-year contract, or a three-year contract initially, wasn't it? So that's $9 million. At that time in 1998, that's the equivalent pretty much of $20 million now.
He can't meet that.
So Bret obviously thinks, go do your 3 years. The screw job is obviously going to pipe down and then you come home. Obviously, he gets a kick.
Everybody comes home.
Yeah, he obviously gets a kick to the head. And, you know, Bret can still obviously, I suppose Bret can still kind of...
Yeah, but I'm not talking even in terms of going back into wrestler or anything like that. I'm talking about even involvement. I mean, like, there's a number of things Bret could have brought to WWE over the years. Forget about even wrestling. You know what I mean? He could have been used in a multitude of positions.
How would you know?
You know what I mean? And I just don't think what you read. If you read what you read about Bret Hart, I just can't see him. I know you might turn around and go right.
You know,
he carried it for 20 years or whatever it is, and still carries it to this day.
It'll go to the grave with him. It'll go to the grave with him as the last great work, as a gift to a man. Ushering out an old era. Like, you're not wrong. What you're saying substantiates what I believe, simply because there is literally maybe five men in that company at that time who you could trust and behold this gift work to. Now, a man who was raised between the ropes, a man who is integrity, he is the last pure child of a territorial era. He's the only one who you could trust as another man, from Vince to Bret. Keep this fucking secret. It'll always be yours. It's the last great work. This is the last piece of work from a bygone era where kayfabe is everything, and you don't travel with your fucking enemies, and you don't get caught in the road with people you're feuding with. You take this to the fucking grave with you, and it will always put food on your goddamn table. There will always be speculation. There will always be Q&As. There will always be meetings. This will perpetuate money in your pocket for the rest of your life. You will come home to me whenever your time is right, whenever you're ready to come home to me. And it's validated by the fact that the guys met in secret, not in an office with lawyers. Vince got into a fucking limo and drove up to some poxy park somewhere near where Bret chose, and the pair of them sat on a goddamn bench and negotiated between men image rights and propriety rights to the Bret Hart name and stuff like that, where Bret could take his gimmick outside of the business and walk around and use it and profit from it. Vince has never given or done that to anybody.
I was gonna say that's kind of what backs up a lot of what Jay might be saying, because it because we look at the whole Ultimate Warrior debacle, which is a show for another day, I know, but with the whole self-destruction of the Ultimate Warrior, you know, the DVD and stuff like that, you know, when people don't want to play ball, that's what happens to them. There was a rumor that they'd done it to Bret and all this, and you know, but there was no actual people that came out, because Roddy Piper's name was thrown in it. That Roddy Piper came out and buried Bret, and Roddy Piper said, I'll fight any man that said that, because I never said anything. And I was never even approached about it. And obviously Piper was a Bret. He was a family member as well. So but there was also what I think really kind of substantiates Jay's point. You know, just to play along with this, to be fair to the listener here. Just to maybe keep an open mind on it. We're not saying that this is 100% true or fact. These are theories. We will never know. However, just if we wanted to play along for a little while and just think about it, I agree with that. For Vince very, very freely to just give up these rights and actually negotiate these rights with Bret, who actually had nothing really to offer to the company on paper, considering he couldn't wrestle. He was willing to do that for a man that obviously couldn't wrestle anymore and obviously needed to kind of do stuff for his book, which is his book that has come out. And then the WWE DVD came out. And if you look at the start of the DVD, it says something like, I believe it was like presented by WWE and Bret Hart. And then on top of that, I think when Bret did eventually come back, That Lloyd's of London, that 10 million. 10 million, by the way, guys. 10 million. One million more than what Brett's deal was in WCW. Mm. That's how much Brett was stood to lose if he got in a wrestling ring. And at WrestleMania, Vince basically allowed Brett to leather the living bejesus out of him with steel chairs. Mm-hmm. And apparently he paid the Lloyd's of London in one shoot. Boom. There you go.
And kept his word.
And kept his word and paid that. And to this day, even though Brett still, to 100%. If for the people that aren't listening there, it's true. Jay is kind of
money.
making it rain without the money, obviously, because we're not Vince McMahon.
even from a fan's perspective, is it not beautiful that we can all still be worked by a business that is so seen through right now that nothing is real anymore? Is this not why we are wrestling fans? Do we not tune in every week since we were fucking knee-high to
a grasshopper?
No, to the showstopper. That is it not wonderful? Is there not a little piece of magic left in the business? The Montreal Screwjob, the single most pivotal point in all talk about works and great works. Is it not beautiful that we can still be fucking fooled by a man who has manipulated us for so long in our life, and we pay to be manipulated? We don't go to WWE for the fucking truth. We go because the truth is bullshit. Our rent, our bills, our hunger, our kids, our fucking safety, the world the way it is now. It's the last bastion of pure escapism. It's movies that aren't movies anymore. They last the span of a lifetime. We'll go to the grave knowing if we don't know the truth of this, it will always make me happy, because I lie in bed after 3 or 4 fucking joints thinking, what the hell did they do to me? How many levels and layers of deception were slathered all over me that I'm still, as an adult, sitting around drinking and talking to men I respect about the possibility of a fucking work? Is that not what it used to be all about and what we'd love it still to be all about?
But the human...
I don't know. I think maybe as wrestling fans, it's what we want it to be. But well, I just agree with where you come from. But I just can't see Bret Hart being that guy. I just can't see it.
But we don't know either way.
Well, that's like if we take all the evidence and look at it clinically, right? This is who Bret Hart is. For years, he was the guy, when there was nobody else around, he was the one who stepped up and grabbed the brass ring. When fucking all that Yoko Ono, Hulk Hogan bullshit was going on, when men were blown into the company who he didn't give a fuck about, and he was replacing them with fake Diesels and fake fucking Scott or Kevin or Razor Ramones, he always had Bret in the corner because he knew this kid came down to me from his fucking father. He is raised industry. He is the integrity of this business. I don't particularly like Bret Hart as a human, right? I don't. I'm not going to pretend I do. I've seen the way he treats his fans. I'm not particularly enamored to him as a person. But the integrity of the man's professional career is without blemish or question. And I can't think of very many other professional wrestlers I can say that about.
But it's not without blemish or question if this has been a work.
Yeah, and that's why it works. You know what I mean? If you're the boss and you're looking at it and going, I mean, they're both in the business of telling lies professionally for money.
I don't think you can sit back and say that your integrity is intact if you've lied to your fan base this long about this issue. If it was a work and after 5 years he came out and he goes, yeah, the whole thing was a work, guys.
Giving you a fuck ton of money to maintain integrity by keeping character and doing a handshake deal with me.
Yeah, but I don't think Bret Hart had any problem making money anyway. Bret Hart probably made more money his life not stepping through the ropes.
Fair. Okay, well, what about the premise that it's also already happened in this business in front of our eyes? When fucking Moolah and what you call whore, is it Alundra? Was it Alundra? Or fucking, no, the fucking Wendy Richter.
Wendy Richter, yeah.
We've already had a screw job.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And we're to believe that Wendy Richter doesn't know that the woman who brought her into the company and trained her wearing a black plastic fucking bag with bleeding webbing underneath her arms is the fabulous Moolah. It's not like she has a sincerely unique fucking body shape or anything. Oh my God, you're not Moolah. And they're still maintaining their work.
We need Sam Tripoli on this show, I'm telling you, man.
You know what I mean?
Blew my mind.
It's not like it's without, without precedent. It happened 10 years before.
But that is very true. I mean, like, we can go back and we can say it like that. We talk about, like, you know, wrestlers kind of keeping their gimmick up and, you know, coming out of the fans. I mean, look, perfect. Case in point, fans are probably wondering why I'm kind of dissing on Scott Hall, for example. It's not because I have a problem with Scott Hall as a wrestler. I have a problem with Scott Hall because the motherfucker got 80 grand to get his fucking hip replaced by fans, by begging his fans to pay it for him. And then he's telling fans to fuck off as soon as he got his hip replaced. That's a fact. One of my own friends was on an airplane and he called him a dickhead. He said, fuck off. In an airport, when he asked him for an autograph, he goes, fuck off, man, I'm not in the humor. And then Storm. Then that's exactly what
he asked. Did he ask him back for that $5 he sent worth of hip?
You know, like it's kind of crazy. Like, no, I don't believe that Bret Hart or any of those people are like that. They're not. I think Scott Hall is a different kind of an animal. And I think the likes of him and Jake.
Well, he killed a guy. He's a little bit mixed up, man.
Yeah, he's not all there. Same with Jake the Snake. You know, Jake's a different kettle of fish. Also, you know, these guys.
There's a podcast in itself, Jake the Snake.
As we're getting to the end of this show, which we are kind of coming to an end, and I know it's going to sound, I know it's going to probably hurt a lot of feelings that are listening to this now, because it's kind of interesting and it's a really kind of cool story and really cool theory, to be fair. We have decided for all of you people, because we are in lockdown, that we are going to be the boss now on what your next show is as well. And we have actually decided that the next show is going to be a review, believe it or not, of WrestleMania 6. And that is going to be Jay's welcoming gift to the show, purely because Jay is the biggest Ultimate Warrior fan you're probably ever going to meet.
I was about to say Jay's review of WrestleMania 6 is just that Hulk Hogan's a cunt.
He looks like 17 hot dogs sellotaped together wearing yellow. He's a gelatinous bitch and I hope he dies. I check the fucking Google every goddamn day. Is Hulk Hogan dead yet? Every night I have to go to sleep. No, he is not. I fucking live with that bullshit. And
you do know he's immortal though, don't you?
Well, listen. People who drive with a sun aren't.
Oh, good Lord. This is going to be awesome.
Oh, ouch.
We've decided to do this.
Because he's this a scumbag.
The sins of the sun.
Well, this is probably... Niall Hogan obviously is related to Hollywood Hulk Hogan, so there is going to be a lot of
support
between...
Kills me. Unless I'm Niall Belay.
Even though it's a kayfabe name.
Hang on. Before we go any further, we should probably have a little shout out here. So to finish off on the screw job, do we believe it was a work or do we believe it was real?
I
believe it was real.
Yeah, me too.
And I believe it was real. a real work.
This is
absolutely work. It was the last great work of a great business. The last piece of business as well. Yeah.
Shit's
going. There's a segue into the next episode.
Jay has literally morphed. For anybody that can't see this, Jay has literally morphed into the Ultimate Warrior. He is now wearing a face mask.
Really?
Except it's not the kind of face mask that the government wants you to wear. It is an Ultimate Warrior face mask, but his eyes have literally become the Ultimate Warrior's eyes. It's kind of crazy. It's really cool. Well, yeah,
it's only the Ultimate Warrior that would get that man to wear the Christmas jumper. I'm saying.
And as the shopkeeper, you would know.
And it could make a guest appearance on the next episode.
It could make a guest appearance on the next episode, and that's
certainly will.
Because the reason we have chosen I suppose we did agree between the three of us, between Jay, Carol, and myself, when shopkeeper's electricity bill wasn't paid. we decided.
We actually put a little electricity in a jar. I'm going to post it out here. I want you to.
Yeah.
I was waiting on the Patreon bump. I was waiting on the Patreon bump.
We're going to get a GoFundMe.
Yeah. Seems to be GoFundMe. GoFundMe seems to be the things these days, don't they?
GoFundMe. Well, if you can get 80 grand for a hip, I'm sure we can get like a couple of quid together for an electricity bill. So.
Going into the meter so we get to the next episode.
Let me tell you something, brother.
But no.
This episode of the Four Pod Man is sponsored by Prepaid Power.
The next episode is literally going to be sponsored by purely banter because obviously I was a Hulk Hogan Mark as a kid. Jay was an Ultimate Warrior Mark as a kid. We love each other, but at the same time, we are socially distancing. It's probably a good idea. We've had this we've had this debate many a time in a bar. In fact, I think we've reenacted the match.
Parties, every conversation we have drunk inevitably ends up with how wrong you are.
No matter what you say, that was a three count with Andre. I don't care.
It was. It always ends with this with the WrestleMania 6 conversation. But a lot of people believe it is the Ultimate Warrior's best wrestling match ever.
I can't watch it.
You don't?
No, I can't.
But Jay has seen something that we haven't seen, a good Ultimate Warrior wrestling match, and he's going to explain it the next show.
Honky Tonk.
Rick Rude.
Exactly.
Macho Man. 2 fucking years to culminate in fighting somebody who looks like a hot dog wearing yellow. Fuck Hogan.
That t-shirt will be now available on Hot Topic.
Glad I'm the shopkeeper.
So we will be doing merch soon as well, and I think Fuck Hogan will be a t-shirt, as said by Jay Kennedy, and it will be available in the shopkeeper shop, which is, of course, Wrestling Mania at the top level. Of Dublin's infamous and famous Stephen's Green Shopping Centre. Niall, why don't you plug what you're doing right now in this pandemic, how people can still avail of some sexy merch?
Yeah, we're just working on revised hours at the moment. So we're working 12 to 4 now, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. But we still have the Facebook page and the postal orders all going. And we just dropped there the other day loads of new Legends t-shirts and stuff like that, and all look really cool. Some nice designs. Yeah, classic designs and stuff like that. Huh?
Is there some Ultimate Warrior ones in there too?
Yeah, Ultimate Warrior, Razor, Brett, Sean, all the good stuff.
Is my COVID payment gone?
I think I'm gonna have to buy Jay an Ultimate Warrior t-shirt just as a gift.
You've already gifted me my favorite Ultimate Warrior t-shirt. I wear it for birthdays and christenings.
I have actually. That's very true. It was bought at WrestleMania weekend. Yeah, on that weekend. So it was a very special time. But look, guys, we do appreciate y'all tuning in to the return of the Four Podmen. We are back now full time, so do not worry. There will come a time, hopefully, where we can bring you shows maybe a little bit more regularly as well. Obviously, to kind of, suffice the fact that we've.
After tonight, how could we not?
Yeah, exactly. After tonight, how could we not? There's people literally going to be sitting there waiting for more, waiting to get back on the treadmill after they fell off. So it's going to be cool. But I think, lads, for me, I'm pretty happy. Any parting words? Anybody want to plug anything before we go?
Well, I have King Wall's Courts back this week, so I should be doing that special episode with some live music. So keep your ears open for that. I'm hoping it's going to be good anyway. Here's fucking
and
hoping.
And your masks and t-shirts are available?
Yes. Yeah,
so the masks are sold out. They're sold out.
No way.
Yeah, t-shirts are still there. So
there's lots of bass players that don't want Carl King Woe to sell masks or t-shirts, you know, former Bitter bass players and all that. But they are protruding through. They are persevering through. They are selling these masks no matter what. They are fighting the fight back. They are fighting the good fight. Two Tails of Woe. Support Two Tails of Woe by getting a mask and saying a big fuck you to a bass player who doesn't want it. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Catch Carl King Woe on the latest episode of Dynamo's Dozen, which is trending right now. Still up and running.
What a rush.
What a rush.
Oh, what a rush. Fuck yeah, brothers and pain. Fuck
Jay
yeah.
Jay isn't trending anything other than fuck Hogan at the moment. That's what you're looking. That's what you're looking.
Listen. I'm trending something right now. It doesn't matter where you are, who you are, what you are, and where you are. Remember, every single time you sit down to escape, make it something you fucking love. If wrestling is something beautiful and something to be held forever, it's because it's the last bastion of innocence. There is nothing wrong with retaining a little bit of your childhood, and there's no better way to do it than the greatest work alive.
Perfect. Perfect way to end.
That is a perfect way to end. And listen, until then, for Ian the Dynamo Kelly, for the shopkeeper, for Jay the DJ, and for Carl King Woe, this is the Four Pod Men, and we will catch you all.